G'day Groovers, just a quick one to let you know that this is part two. Most of you probably already know that because you probably read it. This is part two of my conversation with Bobby. Just continuing on from the previous episode. Hope you enjoy it. How old were you? So you were 10, 12 where you started smoking, drinking and doing recreational drugs. What age were you when you got kind of clean and sober? Is it when you started work? Was it 18?
No, it was younger than that. It was around 16. A few things happened to me. Well, when I was like 15-ish or I don't know, late 14, it's funny when you look back long enough, it's like you have these overlaps. It was either 15, 16. I can't say definitely, but around that time, I started getting into Sokya Gakkai Nichiren Daishonin Buddhism. So I started getting into Japanese Buddhist philosophy, and that started shifting me a little bit. There was a theme about cause and effect relationships, and that was something that impacted me. And then I got into exercise. And then once 16 came around, it just did not, it didn't fit with my identity.
Could you just hit the brakes for one sec?
Mm-hmm.
Oh dear. So here's this kid in Brooklyn, lives in this violent household. He's been given no love. He's got this deformed face by, you know, your own kind of, description. This is pre-surgeries. You've been using drugs. You've been fighting. You've been isolated. And then you go, and I got into Buddhism. How on earth does that kid, get into Buddhism and start to immerse himself in the middle of, you know, this philosophical spiritual exploration?
Okay. Well, this is kind of complicated, as is everything in my story. So my stepfather claimed that he was a Buddhist, which is absurd. It's like
you're the worst Buddhist in the history of Buddhists.
I mean, if they would have found out, they would have revoked his Buddhist membership card instantly. So he thought he was a Buddhist, and he identified as Buddhist. Whatever. I was a kind of like theophile, so to speak, because he also was, you know, Buddhism is, it's not a religion. It's a philosophy, one that he didn't follow, but he was violently atheist. And what I mean by violently atheist is if you presented any other idea other than atheism, he would get very violent. So what I was going, when I was younger, I was going to the Catholic Church. So I would sit in mass on Sunday, and then I would go to Hebrew school with my friends a couple of days a week. And I was just so interested in anything religious. And then, you know, when I got introduced to Buddhism by a friend of mine, my friend Jackie, her mother was a Buddhist. And so I was like, I think I've heard of what that is. And she had asked me, do you want to go to a meeting? And, you know, I was like, well, what do you do at these meetings? Oh, we chant a lot. And, you know, there's, you know, gongyo, and there's the sounds of gongs and incense. I was like, that sounds amazing. I would love to go. So I went, and I just loved it. I love talking about the philosophy. So it just made sense. So I was a Buddhist for a few years until I started dating someone who was like into like New Age and stuff like that. And I never really got into New Age, but I took an interest in it because I really took an interest in her. That's when I was like 20. So
when did you
was my Buddhist period from teens to 20.
The Buddhist, Bobby Cappuccio, the Buddhist years. Coming up next, it's Bobby the Bank Robber. After this break on the U Project, back with more in a moment. What about when did you start to think about or study or research or read or open the door on understanding your mind? Like, I mean, everyone knows that what I'm doing, my research, and I talk to a lot of smart people. I interviewed one of the, you know, Britain's leading neuroscientists, Hannah Critchlow, last night. She was incredible. She'll be up soon, if not before this one.
Can't wait to listen to that.
Yeah, she was great. She's great. But Brainiac, you know, all these, but you, you are right up there in terms of your knowledge and understanding and even your ability. And look, I honestly think, and the academics are going to fucking hate this, I think in some ways you're better because you bring real world experience and insight and stories into the science. And I, as someone who is studying at a high level, I was going to say jealous. I'm on no level jealous. I'm in love with how you think. Like, your brain is amazing. Like, your mind is amazing. And I know you're going to put yourself down now, so just hold back on that. That's how much I know you, right? So hold back on that. But when did you start to become aware of the possibility of managing your mind and your brain? Like, you had this disability, and as you said, you've had, you know, numerous concussions, which is brain damage. A concussion is brain damage. When did you start to think about how you think? And when did you start to be curious about developing your mind and your brain?
It was on a ride across the Verrazano Bridge, going from Staten Island back into Brooklyn. So that's exactly where it was. And, you know, I said that I got a lot of love from work. So when I when I got into the fitness industry back then, and even now, you don't see people who are very overweight or obese going into a gym environment very often. It is a terrifying environment. And in some cases, an unwelcoming environment and not very understanding. Because of the tight community we had and because of the proximity of social contacts and networks, everybody was like a cousin or a brother of somebody else. We did have people in our gym who were obese. And when I first, our gym, I'm talking about Gold's Gym back in the 1990s. That wasn't my first job, but it's where my career really started. I was never overweight. And for me, when I would look at someone who was struggling with obesity, I understood what it was like to have people judge you and not like you just because of your physical appearance. I mean, the response people had to me just because they saw my face had left an imprint on me. And so for me, my reprieve, my outlet was, how can I help these people? What can I do to kind of mitigate their suffering? Because they might not need to go through major reconstructive surgeries, a series of them. They could take series of steps. Now, I don't think I appreciated how long that journey is and what it takes, not just physically, metabolically, but psychologically for someone. But I was highly sincere and committed to partnering with them and doing whatever I can to help them on that journey and holding whatever space they needed. But I started to recognize it's not about sets and reps. You know, as much as I love studying biomechanics and that worked for me, it's not like if these people just had more information on acute variable manipulation, like, problem solved. So you had to go a little bit deeper. And at the same time, my boss, he wanted me to grow in the company. He wanted me to take part in management and leadership, and I kind of didn't want to. And he had a lot of things that he wanted to convey to me, but he didn't think he could quite articulate it as well as some of the tapes he was listening to. So we were on the Verrazano Bridge coming back into Brooklyn. He had told me, all right, come on, we're going for a ride. And that scared me because I thought I was in trouble, because I know he had said to other people, let's go for a ride. And I knew, all right, they were not going for ice cream. So I was like, oh, what's going to happen? And I was like, I was nervous. I was like, is everything going to be okay? It's like, yeah, come on, hop in the car. So we get in the car and he puts on this tape, The Psychology of Winning by Dr. Dennis Waitley. And that was astonishing for me because I was always, like I said, inquisitive. I was always curious. I always had a philosophical slant. Concepts and ideas moved me. They inspired me. And here's someone who's affecting how I feel and how I think, and questions in my mind that he didn't directly ask or put in my mind, but were provoked by the thoughts that he was communicating on a tape. I don't even know this guy. I've never met him yet. And he's completely changing my state. And I'm starting to imagine possibilities for my future. And I'm not talking about 5 years. I'm talking about like 5 hours from now. Like, how can I use this? So that was astonishing. And that was the starting point.
And now you're doing that for others. Do you realize that? Like, you're doing that right now.
Well, that's what we all do, isn't it?
No, not all of us. A lot of people don't. I want to ask you.
Well, not in the same way, but I think most do. Anyway.
But you know what I love? Like, here's what I love. There's two things about you that make you a powerful coach. Obviously, your understanding of human behavior, psychology, the brain, blah, blah, all that stuff's great. But the reason that I wanted to, because we were originally going to talk about learning, and we are, but not in the way that I thought we might, but in a way that's better, which, I, by the way, I'm fucking loving this conversation.
I've written down all my learning talking points right here. Actually, no, wait, that was my lunch order for DoorDash. I'm sorry.
You're an idiot. Put that away. But what I love is that people, it's in stories, like, because your story, well, it's not your story, it's your history. It's a story, but it's real. So for me, it's more than a story. It's an account. It's a biography. It's where you've been. It's your journey. And when you talk honestly and humbly and with great, you know, humility and self-awareness around what you've been through, and you know, and you're still learning and you're still growing, but it gives people hope, because you've been, like, you've been in that shit. You've been in that physical, mental, emotional shit. You've been there, and it, not for 5 minutes. Like, you were born into it. You were born into adversity. And, you know, you're, and I mean, you and I have known each other for maybe 25 years, I know, maybe more, but, you know, and you have your moments and I have my moments, and we had a chat the other day and you had a few challenges and you're a bit flat, but you weren't whinging or sooking. You're just being human, and we're all the same. We've all got shit going on. Like, it's, and challenges are, you know, relative and relevant, aren't they? But, you know, what I love is, in the middle of, you know, all of the stuff that you know and the stuff that you've learned and that you understand on an intellectual level and that you can share and disseminate, because, you know, standing on stage, you're a great speaker and you're inspiring and all of that. But I actually think just where you've been and what you've done and you sharing that, for many people, that's even more powerful. I wanted to ask you, I don't think you and I have ever spoken about you and school, high school. Did you go to school? Did you turn up? Did you hate it? Did you have any good teachers? What was high school like for you?
You know, I did turn up. Junior high school, that's you know what, that was horrible. That's kind of like where you go from like 12, 13, you know, 15.
So is that like, then, I think for us that would be maybe 7, 8, 9, 10, year 7, 8, 9, 10?
Yeah, 7, 8, 9.
Right.
Or it was, I know it's changed, but then I went into high school, which started 10, 11, 12.
Right.
So junior high school was horrible. Wow. I mean, shit happened in junior high school that should not happen in school. High school was a very different experience. I wasn't particularly good. Like mathematics, I was just atrocious. Science, I was interested in, but struggled. It's funny, psychology, I just remembered this. You know, there's things you don't think about, and then somebody asks you a question. It's like, I did do well in psychology because the way my teacher, and he had an interest in me, and he always thought I would be really good in psychology like that. But I didn't think about it. After I took his class, psychobiology, I left. I didn't think about psychology for years. But what the way he created his tests was he would test, and I didn't even know this. I figured it out after I left his class. I was like, oh, that's why I did so well. He would create his tests based on the textbook summary at the back of the chapter. Because our textbook was, the summaries were extensive. It was like 3 pages bullet pointing everything in the chapter. And I used to struggle so hard understanding like the level at which that textbook was written, even though it was for my grade level. You know, I was in nearly like special education classes for math, that I would record into a cassette recorder. You know, so cassettes were these little plastic things with 2 holes in them, and you would stick them in machines and you could play and record things on them. And if you really like someone, you can make what was called a mixtape. And that was indicative of true love. So a little bit of a history lesson. And I would record word for word all the chapter summaries. And it was about an hour of recording. And then on my way to and from work, I would listen to it. See, I am an auditory learner. So, and I didn't even realize, I didn't know it was auditory learning. I was just like, okay, I got to go to work, but I want to learn this. What do I do? And I would just listen to it over and over and over. And then when I would take the test, it was multiple choice. I would recognize that. I'd go, oh yeah. So he thought, wow, you really like study hard, and you know, you're getting good grades. So that class I did well in. He was a good teacher. He was very encouraging. There was a guy, Schoenfeld, who was my history teacher, and I seemed to do well in his class. I never took notes, never studied, but he was a magnificent storyteller. And to me, history was one big story with dates attached to it. So on the test, I would remember a lot of that stuff, where I don't have a particularly great memory, but the teaching medium and my learning style kind of lined up. So I thought history was fascinating. I was so excited. Junior high school, I missed a lot of classes. I was a complete truant. So I would miss so much school. I don't know how I got out of it.
You said that you would, on the way to work, you would study for your exam by listening to this tape.
Mm-hmm.
What was work?
Oh, I had a job at the Y. So I started working at the Y after a while, because I couldn't afford the membership. It was very small. So I got a job so I can be around the gym more. And I didn't really know anything. My job was like, okay, make sure people don't die. Okay, I'll try to do that. I was a lifeguard. I'm not gonna say the place that I was a lifeguard at, but it was in Brooklyn. And I couldn't really swim very well. And what they did, they said, look, this pool's pretty small. So if anyone gets into trouble, if you run to the right spot and take this pole and stick it in the water, they can grab it and you can pull them out. So you don't even have to get in the pool. If someone gets in trouble, you can reach just about anybody with this pole. So I was like, all right, I could do that. So I started working in their weight room, making sure people didn't die, and then sat in the pool, making sure people didn't die. So that was my job.
The problem with that pool philosophy is that you're operating on the assumption that the person in the pool has the capacity to grab the stick. Now, if somebody's floating face down, they're not grabbing any stick.
Oh, we had a net as well.
Now, you say, I mean...
Okay, I should not have been a lifeguard. I see that now.
Well, no shit. I have a point of contention. You said you don't have a great memory. I've literally seen you do 5, 6, 7 minute monologues where you are, by memory, reciting some amazing piece of literature, which must be 1 or 2,000 words, where you've memorized it and you deliver it like you wrote it. I mean, we all know that you're just sharing something. Like, how does a person with not a very good memory, like, I think you have one of the best memories of anyone I know. Like, has that changed since then? Did you train your memory? Because I would have almost said you have an eidetic memory.
Yes.
So many people have said that. I never said I didn't have a strategy. I said I do not have innately a great memory. What I have is an ACT. And ACT is my own little acronym for access, context, and teaching. See, a lot of things that I've learned about learning occurred accidentally. So I think so many of us have greater powers for memory than we think we do, but it's linked to hippocampal function. So the hippocampus initiates, it's responsible for the initiation and in processes that support long-term potentiation of memory. And so the emotional state you're in greatly affects what you're able to not only learn, but recall, access later. So for example, if you eat something different every day, you probably couldn't tell me what you had for lunch 2 days ago, but you could probably tell me the most emotionally moving pivotal scene in your favorite film. And you might not have seen that film for over a decade because it emotionally moved you. And for me, I fell in love with the purpose of what I was doing. So like I said, I found love and I found acceptance and I found significance in work. That's where I could become uniquely valuable. So the subjects that not only I was interested in, but elevated my level of emotional arousal in a very positive way to draw me to that information, allowed me to prime my brain to learn more effectively. Second thing is context. I was fortunate that I was working in environments where I could literally sit down and say, well, how can I use this information? And I had the advantage of immediacy. So I could be sitting in a break room or even in my car reading through a book because I was obsessive. I would read everywhere. And then I could start a shift on the gym floor and I could see somebody doing any combination of a push, a pull, squat, lunge, twist, and go over and have a conversation when they weren't telling me like, fuck off, I'm in the middle of training. But if they would let me speak to them, I can convey what I was learning in a real situation in a way that added value and that was rewarding. So that created context around what I was learning. And then my boss, you know, we've talked about this before, he valued oration. He valued public speaking. So initially he forced me to do it. It was a job requirement, but then I grew to love it. So then part of my trainings that I was doing, whether I was volunteering in the community with different organizations or whether I was leading team meetings, I could then teach what I knew. And when I was able to teach it, I was able to retain a lot of it. So that became my strategy. I had an ACT.
So just give us that acronym again.
Access, which is what is the emotion that you're attaching to what you're learning? Why is this relevant? Context, how can I use this? When and where can I use this? And teach what you know. Like if you just learned something yesterday,
yeah.
But like my wife will ask me questions constantly about things because she's very curious. You know, if there's something that I just learned and I only have a day of experience with it, yeah, I have no expertise whatsoever, but she doesn't have any days of experience. And if I teach her what I just learned, I retain it. Yes. So it helps both of us.
Yeah.
Give stuff away, be generous with what you know.
Yeah. One of the things I suggest people do when they come to my workshop is as much as they can or whatever, you know, whatever we're in the middle of, you know, listen intently, write. Doesn't work for everybody, the writing, but for a lot of people, take as, you know, might just be a word or an idea or a phrase, something that I say that resonates with you. Because it resonates for a reason. It provokes something, write it down. And then later when you go back and you've got 5 pages of words or key ideas or phrases, then that's going to bring you back to that moment in time. And you're going, you know, it's very hard to retain if you're listening to 180 minutes worth of information and ideas and words and stories. It's very hard to retain that, let alone put it into practice. And if you can't remember it, you can't use it. And so the first thing is trying to, you know, remember as much as possible that's relevant and potentially valuable. But also then I also say try and teach the stuff that you think really matters or is important or potentially valuable to you and others, share that with somebody within the first 24 hours. So, you know, I learned something interesting last night. So I'm going to teach you. I didn't know this. You probably already know this. So Dr. Hannah told us that the brain, which is generally only about 2% of the body weight, uses about 20% of our energy. Mm-hmm. How amazing is that? That's bloody, it uses 10 times more energy than the rest of the body weight per kilo, if you know what I mean. So there, I've learned something last night. Now I've taught, well, I didn't teach it to you because you already knew it, but I taught it to a few people.
You taught it to me.
Go on.
You taught it to me. I just wrote
another acronym if you're interested in it, because I don't know if this, because people have different learning styles. So what works for me isn't necessarily going to work for everybody.
Yeah.
But there's a few things, because I've always had trouble learning, there's a few strategies I've had to create, and that creates mental models and frameworks that facilitate the learning process. Like when you talk to me, I always have an acronym because those are the frames. So if we're going to talk about coaching, I'll talk about real coaching, which is, you know, what does someone really want? What's the evidence for that? You know, what do you need to assess as the coach? And then, you know, what are the limiting factors that stop them from having what they want? And that's kind of like the foundation or the pillars. And if you have those pillars, you can kind of pour cement in between them. Not like you should ever get into a coaching conversation with a preliminary idea about where you want that conversation to go, but it kind of helps you navigate. You can use that for sales. You know, I just came up with the ACT. So for me, it was a matter of how do I create these cohesive steps that no matter what I'm learning, I just go, where does this fit? So each one is a file. So if I'm in front of a room or I'm giving a meeting or I'm out on, well, not on the fitness floor for a long time, or if I'm consulting, where did I put that information? And I have files to choose from. So I can open any file if I understand the framework. So when I used to read, one method that helped me, and I don't think this is the exact thing, I just made up this acronym right now, is READ is an acronym that stands for Review, Evaluate, Ask, and Describe. So I would open up a textbook. And I remember the first time I ever did this was with Norkin and Lavangi's Joint Structure and Function, because I was struggling with it. And I would imagine myself sitting down with Norkin and Lavangi and asking questions, because I started to discover that if I would read a book or a chapter that was deep in science, somebody asked me, well, what was 2 points you got out of that? I would struggle. But if I sat down with someone who was really smart, I would remember key points from the conversation. So before I would read a chapter, I was like, well, what's most important right now? What do I want to ask these brilliant authors? What's one thing I want to get out of it? And then I would go through the book and I would read, you know, the chapter headings and then the subheadings. Yep. And then in a lot of textbooks, they'll take that. There's kind of like this box and a diagram that summarizes the main point that they're discussing in the past 2 pages. And I would just read that. And just by reviewing that, I would say, which one of these is relevant like to my question? So I would go to the next step, evaluate. And then when I found one of those boxes that was relevant, I'd say, okay, now I'm going to go ahead and read the content that this is based on. I'm going to do an in-depth read on these couple of pages because this diagram speaks to my question. And then I would go through, and before I read those couple of pages, I just wouldn't read them word for word. I would read, well, what's italicized, what's bold typed, and what do I want? Because that's what the author thinks within those sentences is particularly relevant for you. And I would ask another question. What do I want to ask in regard to these specific areas that the author has highlighted as being particularly significant? And I would go through and read that as if that was the answer to my question. And then I would take that and I would describe it. I would either describe it to somebody else. I would describe it on paper, just write down what I'm learning, or I would describe it to myself and make another audio recording. I made a lot of audio recordings, not because I like the sound of my own voice, but because, you know, sometimes you want to talk to somebody and there's nobody around to talk to. So you just have to do it that way. And I would go through that. And by going through review, evaluate, ask, and describe, I would retain so much more information and be able to go through more information, because it's almost like all of my books, it's in my imagination, it's a room of authors, kind of like Napoleon Hill in Think and Grow Rich, where he had his imaginary mastermind. And all of these people in history that had inspired him, he would sit with them and converse with them. He had to stop doing it at one point because these people became so real. They had idiosyncrasies. And like, he was like, okay, this is becoming problematic. I never got to that point, although I think that would have been cool. But I used to do that. I used to dialogue with people.
I think it's like, yeah, I love that. You know, it's like you're telling yourself a story because there's emotion in story, where there's not so much emotion in data or facts, but then you can recall the data and the facts. How much of your, so you literally developed your own learning style. Like, nobody taught you that. You figured that out, which is bloody amazing. But how much of what you share now as a coach and as a speaker when the world's not in a global pandemic, or even on podcasts, how much of what you share or what you know is about, is a byproduct of study, reading, listening, onboarding data, onboarding information, versus real life, interactive, experiential learning? Like, do you trust your own evidence-based anecdotal experiences enough to be able to share them with people as information, versus like, do you realize that you're an expert in your own right?
I have a, what I consider to be a constructive level of skepticism about my own viewpoints, beliefs, and mental models. I share things with confidence because I have an archive of people and organizations, in some cases, very large organizations that have benefited from the things that I've shared and the work that we've done. Yet I'm always asking myself, where am I incorrect? Where is the context where what I'm saying would be irrelevant? Because I'm always questioning what I know. But you have to have that belief and openness at the same exact time. A lot of times we're looking for the soundbite. We're looking for the clear cut direction. You know, is this a yes or a no? You know, do you lean left or do you lean right? And I think the world is far more nuanced than that. So I remember I was in Melbourne. And I was watching a friend of mine present, and we were on this speaking tour. Actually, Taylor popped up and did a Q&A with me in front of the room this day. And I was watching my friend go through the same presentation I saw 5 days in a row. And he was one of my favorite speakers, but okay, it's day five. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to chat to his wife a little bit in the back. And she had been a very successful stage performer. And to me, the performing arts has always been interesting to me. And now that I'm at an age where I can be open about that, because I couldn't when I was a kid, I have a lot of, I have a lot of inquiry and a lot of curiosity. I said, well, what's the difference between someone who just does a play and someone who is a Broadway West End level performer? And she said, well, there's a lot of things that go into that, but these people have these enormous, larger than life, unrelenting egos. And they are beautifully, inspiringly humble in the same persona. So it's always both. So I step forward, like when I'm speaking, with a resolute belief and a conviction in what I'm saying, because I have care and there's intention there. But at the same time, when I'm off stage, I'm open to where there's flaws in my thinking. So it's both. It's not one or the other for me.
Mm.
I feel like there's a better way I should be saying this.
No, no. It's,
but I'm struggling with it. No, but there's, because there's things like if you're not reading theoretically, you're not in a space where you're stepping back and you have a strong enough vantage point to gain awareness about what it is you're saying and what the exceptions are. But then there's got to be a point where you just jump in and commit to it, and you can't learn theoretically. The only way to learn is experientially. Here's an example. If I wanted to go swimming and I bought a book on the biomechanics of swimming and I learned everything there is biomechanically to know about how to swim, I've never been in a pool before. Am I going to be able to swim? No, I wouldn't go jumping in the deep end, especially if they had me back in the day on lifeguard duty. You're going to drown. You're going to die. You have to get in the water and learn how to swim through personal experience. Now, do you need to even read the book to learn how to swim? No. But can you explain swimming theoretically to somebody else? Probably not. So you need the marriage of theory and practice.
Mm. Mm. And by the way, I did a semester of the theory of swimming, worst subject ever. And so just Google.
Of course you did. Why would you not?
Just Google Bernoulli's principle, everyone. There you go. You'll bloody love that. It'll keep you busy for half an hour.
That is the strangest thing you've ever said. I don't know why. No.
Oh, yeah. It's all about lift and drag coefficient. And
okay, that makes sense now.
Yeah. I was going to ask you something else, but you do make a good point. I'm thinking that, like, for me, where I've learned the most on what's helpful to me, like what's made my life better, what's made me better at what I do, where I've learned the most is literally at the coalface, you know. So setting up my first gym when there were no PT studios and figuring out how to be a boss and how to employ people and how to run a business and grow a business and marketing and deal with taxation and deal with councils and deal with permits and deal with problem clients and deal with egos and attitudes and personalities and anatomy and physiology and movement and adaptation and like the totality of everything that's involved when you're the captain of the ship and you're literally feel like you're making stuff up. But the learning curve is so steep. You're either going to learn a lot or you're going to blow up, you know, or sometimes a bit of both. But for me, that I'm very much an experiential learner. But what is interesting is about 2018. So I started my PhD at Monash and I'm in the neuroscience department and we have a big facility that I'm part of, which is called Brain Park. And I got asked to come in about a year and a half before, a year before I started my PhD, because one of the guys there follows my stuff and they're interested in, because I deal practically with big audiences and lots of humans around creating change and human behavior and all the stuff that that they explore in terms of addiction. And I worked at an addiction treatment center as well. And so they asked me to come in to talk to the team. And it was interesting because, like, here's this guy that's like far and away the least qualified person in the room in terms of academic credibility, far and away. Everybody in the room was either a professor, a PhD graduate, a PhD student, people with, 7-8 degrees, some of them. And I'm in there talking to them about how I help people change and what I do. And I say, well, look, everyone that comes to me comes because, look, a range of reasons, but the one commonality is they all want to be different, think different, do different, create different, look different, function differently. And it's physical, it's mental, emotional, it's practical, it's organization. Sometimes it's financial, sometimes it's, painful, sometimes it's joyful, sometimes it's messy. But this is what I do with people. And they were fascinated with how I know the stuff that I know about human beings, not having studied like they'd studied psychology and human behavior. And they're essentially, some of them were going, how do you know all this? I go, because I've been literally doing this with humans my whole life since I was 18 years old. And so at that stage, what was I, probably 53 or something? I go, so that's 35 years of having tens of thousands of conversations with mm-hmm. humans who want to look different or feel different or function differently, and who have a history of stopping and starting and motivation and demotivation and pain and pleasure and self-doubt and self-loathing and fear and anxiety and overthinking and self-sabotage. And they're like, fuck, yeah. You know, and it's, so I think if you're at the coalface of whatever you do and you really
mm-hmm.
listening and paying attention to others and being present with others, and understanding others, then you can become great at what you do without necessarily mm-hmm. picking up a book on that subject. I'm not suggesting we don't pick up books, of course. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, like, some of the best coaches and teachers, of course we all need education, of course, but you and I both know people who are theoretically brilliant but practically stupid.
Okay, yeah, that's something completely different. I mean, a pet peeve of mine, something I am fanatical about. You don't know shit until you step in the arena. You don't know shit until you sit with someone and you are present. You don't know shit until you practice your craft in real life situations over and over, because that's when you're going to make the most mistakes. And without mistakes, you're not learning. I mean, if you're not going back and evaluating and extracting what went wrong, what did I intend to happen versus what actually happened? What are the course corrections? Reapply that. And to be able to learn at that speed and to be able to get that much intentional practice only comes from doing the actual thing. Nothing annoys me more. I think it's an outright act of betrayal. And I know these people, you just said it just hit a trigger. People who go out and they teach sales courses to audiences, and a lot of times they're employed by a company where it's their job to do that. You have never actually sold. You've never sold, not saying that you have to sell in that same exact environment, but you've never actually sold. And the theoretical shit you're telling people are going to get them hurt, because that stuff does not work. And the response they're going to get, if you know where you want to go, right? And you have context, and you get a response that is not what you're looking for, you can step back, you can modify, you can adapt. It's still going to hurt, but good, because hurting's part of the learning process as well. It's a combination of where curiosity intersects with frustration and a little bit of passion behind that, that where something that's sacred enough for me where I'm willing to suffer for it. I think that's the triad. That's the cocktail in learning and development. But if all you have is that and you don't have the context to adapt, you're going to be frustrated because you're going to get overwhelmed, and people are going to quit early because you fed them bullshit because you were never in the environment that you're supposed to be preparing them for. And the people in the seats collectively have more knowledge and experience than the person in front of the room. Same thing if you've never led a team to hit budget month after month after month. If you don't know what mid-month closeout is like, you don't know what the end of the month closeout is like, and you're teaching people leadership and how to manage a department, but you've never done it, that is atrocious. Mm. I think it's the same thing with any craft.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. You know, we've been talking for nearly an hour and a half. How long is it, Melissa? Is it like 1:20?
Yeah, it's like 1:25, I think. Thereabouts. Wowza.
Well, we could bang on for a long time. I've got one last question for you. What... is there one thing, that one issue or one challenge that you've dragged with you from childhood to now that you still deal with? Is there one particular thing that for you is an ongoing challenge emotionally or behaviorally or cognitively?
Hmm. probably, I'm answering as objectively as I'm capable of answering. So in addition to not being very good looking, I've gotten over that. I think it's been, even though I've denied it, I've always had this deep desire for family.
Right.
I've always been trying to find a surrogate family. Yeah. And sometimes I'm looking for that in the wrong places. I mean, not like a brothel or something like that,
yeah.
But I'm saying I'm looking for it in places where I'm probably not going to find it.
Mm.
Not authentically.
Mm.
And that has gotten me into a lot of trouble.
Mm. Have you trusted people too quickly in the past?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I think,
were you keen to believe what people are saying?
Yeah. I think a lot of us fall into that trap. We should do another one soon, because I think there's a lot of doors I still need to open. And by the way, you're welcome for this therapy.
You should be sending me a bill.
How do people connect with you, my friend? How do people follow you and become part of your tribe?
Yeah, well, I have my podcast, The Self-Help Antidote. You can find that. You can find that anywhere. You can find that on, Google, Spotify, Apple, iTunes, anywhere, pretty much anywhere you can find podcasts, except for Pandora, because I'm having trouble setting it up for some reason. You can find that. I'm on Instagram, Facebook. I'm not really on social media very much because I think social media has a lot of benefits.
Mm.
For me, it's not what I want for my mental health. So I'm still there though. You can find me on Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram if you like.
All right, mate. Well, thank you for being open and honest and raw and real. And thank you for being you. Our audience loves you and we love you. And we appreciate you coming on the show. And,
I love you guys.
Bring something amazing. Well, we love being loved. It's very fucking loving here. Melissa, did you have a good time?
Touchy-feely.
Very good time. Thank you. Thank you so much, Bobby. What a conversation to listen in on. That was great. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Stay there, Bobby. Hey, everyone. Thank you so much. Do me a favor and have a listen to the great man's podcast. Follow him. Give him a little bit of love. He's got a lot of issues. God love him. Let's just get around him, shall we? Let's give him a little bit of family. We could be his family. See you next time, everyone. Love you.